Every work team has moments of conflict and dysfunction. Sometimes productive conflict is a necessary part of wrestling through big ideas to get to the best possible outcome. But sometimes our teams become mired in conflict that is entirely avoidable because it's based in vastly different communication styles or different motivations and misunderstandings. Enter the Enneagram. The Enneagram offers not only self-awareness, but also curiosity and deeper understanding of others. I teach the Enneagram and consult with teams to improve their communication styles, conflict effectiveness, and self-leadership, all of which foster highly engaged and high-performing teams. During a recent team event, I heard over and over, this just makes so much sense when they looked around the room and saw who was fitting within each type. And now I know why this person asked so many questions, or this depersonalizes some of the conflict we've been having because I can tell we're just coming from different perspectives. So now that we know where we are, we can see how we can get aligned. So if you're looking for ongoing support or simply considering an engaging introspective module for your team's offsite or event, let's talk. Reach out to the Nine Types team at hello@ninetypes.co or schedule a one-on-one consultation with me on my website, ninetypes.co. And now, on to the show. Welcome to Ask an Enneagram Coach. I'm your host, Steph Baron Hall. I'm a certified Enneagram coach, creator of Nine Types Co. on Instagram, and author of the new book, The Enneagram in Love. Every week, you can find me here answering all of your pressing Enneagram questions so that you can understand yourself more clearly and find new paths toward growth. Let's get started. On today's episode of Ask an Enneagram Coach, we're going to be going back to the basics. So today's episode will be all about questions like, what is the Enneagram? How do you find your type? What is core motivation? How do you find your core motivation? Can your type change? And what do you do when you really can't figure out your type? A lot of you guys who are listening probably are really familiar with the Enneagram already, but I also know that this type of tool, so the Enneagram, is so complex. The beauty of it is really in that complexity, and I really want to reiterate some of the basics of the tool so that we can all use it for our growth and for our own flourishing. So to start off, I'm going to be talking about what the Enneagram is overall. So basically, the Enneagram is a personality tool that is oriented around nine core motivations. And when I say personality tool, that's not actually my favorite way to describe the Enneagram, but it's the one that makes the most sense to people. A lot of people liken the Enneagram to something like Myers-Briggs typology, StrengthsFinder, DISC, these other personality typologies. And while I see it as really different from those, the similarity is in that it's kind of whittling down the personality in a way that we can all understand. So I don't, you know, I know a lot of people are like, don't put me in a box. I don't want to be put in a box. And I don't see the Enneagram as putting us in a box. Rather, I just see it as a way to understand ourselves, give us common language to understand ourselves so that we can go deeper, so we can like question our patterns and our motivations, and so that we can move forward. So that's why I describe it still as a personality typology, even though that's not my favorite way to discuss the Enneagram. With that, I'm actually going to go over, first I'm going to start with what is core motivation? The reason I'm starting there, and I know this is a little bit out of order from how I listed the questions at first, but the reason I'm starting with what is core motivation is because I don't think core motivation is really something that we're used to talking about. Like, I don't think that I'm in the United States, so I don't think the U.S. culture is really, really accustomed to talking about the concept of motivation. We talk about motivation in terms of motivational quotes or whatever, but we don't really talk about motivation in the same way that we talk about with the Enneagram, which is that it's a persistent driving force that is really underneath all of our outward behavior, the way we move through life, the way we interact with others. We have this core motivation underneath all of that. So it's really important to differentiate that from behavior. So behavior is how that looks on the outside. And that is where the Enneagram really differs from some of those other personality profiling tools that I mentioned earlier, because the Enneagram, right, we all know it's about core motivation. We've talked about it a bunch. Whereas those other tools often are not focused on motivation. They're more focused on outer behavior. But we all do similar things for very different reasons. And so that's why I want to go back to the basics, back to the motivation with the Enneagram, because I find that a lot of the time when people are trying to understand the Enneagram and understand how to find their type, what they're missing is the core motivation piece, either of the types as they're reading them, or they're missing the core motivation piece of in their own life. Like what is motivating us? So that's kind of what core motivation is. It's a persistent driving force that is underlying everything, like kind of as a common thread throughout our life that we may or may not be aware of. So really important to understand, we're not always aware of this thing. We have this force, we have this driver, but it's not necessarily cognitive or conscious. It's more so, it's like buried, you know? And so it takes some work to uncover it and peel back the layers and really understand what's underneath. So the next question, how do you find your core motivation? That can be tough. Like I said, we're not used to using this language. We're not used to these words. So how you find your core motivation is not as fun and like, it's not like a quiz. It's not like an assessment. It really is self-reflection. So I really think that if this is your first foray into the Enneagram, you probably haven't built the skills you need to observe your motivation. And that's okay, but it simply starts, like I said, with self-reflection and self-discovery. Observe yourself without judgment. Your journal is going to be your best friend in this process. So journal about what's underneath the things you're doing. Look inward. Just try to understand. Just like learning the Enneagram so that you can explain away some of your troublesome behaviors is not the point. The point is actually to go deeper and to really be focused on that self-observation piece. So as you begin to understand your core motivation, what I really want you to ask is why. Say, this is a great example because often I think we see ourselves most clearly in our shadows. So say, like, think of something, maybe an interaction you had with someone else or an incident or a response that you had that you really didn't like. So imagine the last time that happened and ask yourself, why? Why did I do that? Why did I respond that way? Why did I say that thing? Why did I get so frustrated? Why did that upset me so much? And just start digging with that question. Why? And at some point, you will get to a place where the why has reached an end and there's nothing else underneath it. And that really is about your core motivation. So maybe what's underneath it is you really felt insecure in that moment and wanted guidance and felt like the rug had been pulled out from underneath you and you didn't have the stability that you were looking for. So look at that as your core motivation, if that makes sense. So that's how you find it. With that, the core motivations of all nine types kind of falls into these nine buckets. And as you study the Enneagram and study yourself, you'll see yourself a little bit more and more in each of them. And you probably will see a little bit of yourself in all of the nine types. That's just how we are as humans. I think we all have all nine types within us in some way, shape, or form. But we all have one that's really core, that's really driving, that is the clearest and most consistent and the strongest motivation. And that's the one that is going to be your core type. And right now, I'm just setting this all up for you because I want you to understand like how to get to it, you know, how to get to the bottom of it. So I'm going to talk through all nine types. But one of the questions that I often get before I get into this is, can your type change? Because a lot of the time we look back at different points in our lives and we think that our type has changed because we seem to be really different from different times. There are a couple of reasons for that. One is your wing. So maybe your wing shifted. Two, could be your subtype shifted. And if both of those things are confusing for you, that's totally fine. But after you listen to this episode, go back to episode 2 where I talk about wings and subtypes, because that might be really clarifying for you. So that's kind of two things to keep in mind. But your type doesn't change throughout life. Normally we see our types most clearly when we're like 18 to 25, when we're really stuck in our personality patterns and serving our own needs. But as you get out of those patterns, and as you start to grow just as a person, you will find yourself having more balance. So you'll find yourself less obviously in your core type and more like having a little bit more balance. With that, I will say a lot of Enneagram teachers will say, if you don't know your type, you're either a 6 or a 9. And that is actually really, really poignant because there are a couple of reasons. So basically, I'll get into this in an episode where I talk about stances. But basically, there are 3 types that are dominant and repressed in the same center, meaning that they have a dominant intelligence center, and then that same, the element that's associated with that same intelligence center is repressed. So the 3 elements I'm talking about are doing, thinking, and feeling. Doing goes with the body center typically, thinking goes with the head center typically, and feeling goes with the heart center typically. But 3, 6, and 9 are dominant in the same center that they're repressed in. So 3s are dominant in the heart center and repressed in feeling. 6s are dominant in the head center and repressed in thinking. And 9s are dominant in the body center and repressed in doing. And so what ends up happening with that is, as you can imagine, there is kind of a disconnect where it's almost like there's a gap between those things. And their thing that is their core intelligence is something that they're also repressing for various reasons. So 3s often have a hard time finding their types because, again, I'll say 3s, 6s, and 9s have the hardest time knowing themselves of all the Enneagram types. So 3s, they often really they have a hard time accepting their type. Like 3s in general, I am a 3, so I'm just going to kind of say this really honestly. 3s just don't know themselves. They're not naturally very self-aware. It takes a lot of effort and a lot of time for them to get there. And then once they do get there, maybe after a big failure or something like that, it's really surprising to them that they have been fooling themselves into thinking of themselves a little bit differently from others. So what I mean by that is, like, 3s really, they think what they're doing through going through life and being successful is that they're getting all this worth. But what they're actually getting is they're finding value. They believe that they're building worth for themselves, but actually what is valuable about them is not all of these accolades, but it actually is who they truly are at their core and their true heart. They have deceived themselves into thinking that their worth is in their success, when in actuality, their worth is in who they are at their core and just the fact that they're human. And so that can kind of cause a disconnect where they just don't know themselves that well. So that's 3s, and that's kind of why once they do find their Enneagram type, a lot of the time they continually second guess it. They're like, am I really a 3? They're really used to being a chameleon and fitting in wherever they can. And so I think a lot of 3s do have a really hard time accepting that they are a 3. So 6s are a little different. 6s really want, they tend to build an inner committee. So they tend to kind of create, maybe it's actual people around them or inside their head, they kind of have an inner committee that is like questioning or verifying their assumptions or their beliefs or whatever. So a lot of times 6s will have a really hard time because they tend to be really indecisive. They tend to not trust themselves. And in doing so, they don't trust themselves about who they are. And once they get past that, I mean, some 6s do really trust themselves and they don't trust anyone else. But a lot of 6s don't trust themselves. They don't really resonate with like what they believe about themselves. So they constantly are asking somebody else for their opinion. And often when they're doing that, they don't actually want somebody else's opinion. Often what they really want is reassurance that their original opinion was correct. So 6s often have a really hard time, and 6s are really, really hard to capture and hard to describe. And so because they can be so different, there's so much diversity in what a 6 actually shows up like, that they're hard to describe, until a lot of 6s don't see themselves in the common descriptions of 6s. And then finally, 9s. 9s have the absolute hardest time like figuring out their type. I do a lot of typing sessions, and the overwhelming majority of my clients are 9s. And reason being, kind of the theory around this is actually that nines are at the top of the Enneagram. So when you look at the Enneagram shape, nines are at the very, very top. And so the concept is that they look down over all the other types and can understand all the other types and kind of glean something and see truth from all the other types. And that is a big aspect of it. They're the mediators, the peacekeepers. They really just, they're really in tune with the thought process of others. And they can really kind of take the perspective of everyone else around them. And there's also an aspect of nines that's like, they spend so much time and energy trying to keep the peace within that they have muted or repressed anything that could disrupt them or rock the boat. So they end up really not knowing themselves, because knowing themselves and knowing their opinions and their thoughts and ideas could potentially rock the boat, and that would be really hard. And so instead they end up kind of suppressing it and really believing that who they are at their core doesn't matter. And they end up just tamping it all down, and they are really quiet. And not that they're quiet in general. Like, I don't think that nines are quiet people in general necessarily, but that they quiet themselves. They quiet the core essence of who they are. And so they have a really hard time because they could see themselves playing the role of any of the Enneagram types. So it's hard for them to understand that what their core motivation is actually that peacekeeping and comfort and quiet. So that's why those three types have a really hard time finding their types. So if you have, I would say threes generally, especially if they've experienced a big failure or have experienced loss, they typically are a little bit more aware of their motivations, but sixes and nines especially have a really hard time. So keep that in mind as you listen through. If you are really feeling like you don't resonate strongly, it might be that you need to look closer at one of those types. So also I will say that it's hard to capture the core motivation of each of the types in a short period of time. And so I want you to keep in mind, keep an open mind, keep listening, keep observing yourself. My tips about finding your type are actually really focused on, you doing the self-reflection work and the learning and the studying. And I know that it's not as fun as taking a test. I love taking online tests, but it actually is the thing that's going to help you grow. Because if we're using a self-discovery tool, but we're not using self-discovery to find our place in this tool, then we're already starting to bypass the work. So keep that in mind as you listen. And I'm going to go through all nine Enneagram types and their core motivations so that you can understand yourself a little bit better. And hopefully you'll be able to gain a little bit more clarity on your type, and maybe you'll even be able to describe what the Enneagram is to people around you. So I think that's going to be really important. If you want other people around you, don't beat them over the head with it. But if you want people around you to understand the Enneagram and to get into it with you, it's helpful if you can just briefly describe what the Enneagram is. So I'm going to get to that in just a few minutes after the break. Today's episode is sponsored by Nine Shapes. Nine Shapes is a company created by a friend of mine named Ashley Sikorsky. She's a certified coach and an Enneagram teacher, and she really created this beautiful deck of cards. I mean, they are so, so beautiful, and they're inspired by the work of Henri Matisse, and I also love Matisse like Ashley does, so it's so cool to get them in the mail. But basically, this deck of cards, Nine Shapes, is a project that she created to help people understand themselves a little bit better, to understand one another better, and create really deep, meaningful conversation around questions based on Enneagram types. So basically how it works is you pull a card when it's your turn, and you ask, and each card, it's oriented by type, and then by intelligence center, and then by like just general. So there are different questions on each card. And so say I pull a card for a type six, then there's a six in the circle, and I'll ask that type six this question. And it's a deep, thought-provoking question that kind of really cultivates conversation. And it's awesome. I, to be honest, wasn't sure when I got them what to expect, but they're so beautiful. And I actually brought them out when my family was doing a Zoom meeting across, you know, three time zones for Mother's Day. And we had such a great time asking these deep, thought-provoking questions of one another. And it was just so fun because I thought that my siblings were not going to be into it, but actually one of them, when we went through one round, was like, oh, is that it? Are we not going again? You know? So it was just awesome to be able to connect in that way. And that's really what Nine Shapes is about. It uses the Enneagram framework, but it doesn't reduce who we are into something that is like overly simplified or reductionist. It really focuses on the beauty and the depth and the meaning behind not only the Enneagram, but every single person that is in the circle, that's in the room. So it's a game-ish, but it's also really contemplative and thoughtful and really beautifully done. So I definitely recommend Nine Shapes if you are doing a family gathering like I was, or you just love having good conversations with your friends. It's a really great way to add a little structure while you think about how to have more vulnerable and meaningful conversations. So go to nineshapes.co to check it out. I'm also going to put it in the show notes, but Nine Shapes is just an awesome partner for me, and I've really enjoyed working with them. So make sure to go check out those cards and let me know what you think, because obviously I love them and I really think you'll love them too. So that's nineshapes.co to buy your own box of Nine Shapes cards. Okay, back to the show. I'm going to go through each of the nine types really quickly, and hopefully this will help you create more understanding and more language around each Enneagram type. You've probably heard people call the types by certain names or like monikers. So for example, for one, it's the reformer, the perfectionist, or the improver, and I'll name those, but I will also say that I don't use those when I'm teaching the Enneagram or when I'm typing people, because what I find is that often people are really attracted to those names or really repelled by those names, and they don't look past it to get to the core motivation. And so, for example, for type three being called the achiever, a lot of ones are like, well, I'm an achiever, so like I don't understand why I wouldn't be that type. And so it kind of detracts from it. But I want to share them with you today because I want you to be able to kind of match them back. Like if you've seen the type one always be called the perfectionist, and then I don't say the perfectionist, you might not understand that I'm actually talking about the type one. So I'll say them today, but keep in mind, if you don't resonate with the name, but you resonate with everything else I say about that type, then you are probably that type. Also, I will say, if there's a type that feels like it resonates with you, but you hate it, that is probably your type. And I know that feels really hard. But that is actually one of the best ways to find your Enneagram type, is to look at the really unhealthy sides of it. Look at the really low sides of it. I might actually do an entire episode about the unhealthy aspects of each type, because that's where we really see ourselves and that's where we really find where we need to grow and can actually grow. So let's get started. Type ones are diligent and industrious. They are often known as the perfectionist, the reformer, or the improver. They're idealists who view the world in terms of what could be, and therefore they work tirelessly to perfect their environment. They're motivated by the need to be good, right, and perfect. And this is more about integrity, morality, and ethics than it is about being the best. So they have a strong sense of justice and want to make the world a better place, both for themselves and for others. And they're in the gut or anger triad, meaning they have gut intuition. Their underlying most common emotion is anger, but they suppress their anger because they believe it isn't right or appropriate to express it. So their core fears are really being corruptible, bad, lacking balance, or making the wrong decision. And especially their worst fear is making the wrong decision and being the last to know about it. So like, for example, if they make a bad decision and then other people point out that they are wrong, but don't tell them specifically, they kind of talk about it aside from approaching it with a one. So that feels awful. If they make a bad decision, they want to be the first to know. Or even like if they make a mistake, like that's really hard for ones because they have like this inner critic that's constantly berating them and like telling them that they should do better, they should be better. A lot of us have negative self-talk, but for ones, it's really, really pervasive. It's a little bit different from the negative self-talk a lot of us experience. I will also say if you have a type 1 parent, you might experience some really similar self-talk to the one's inner critic, because often the voices that we hear from our parents become the voices inside our heads. So just really important to keep that in mind. But with ones, again, like they're all about integrity and doing what's right and being good, like being truly deeply good. But that is about their own personal code of ethics and their own personal morality. And they don't necessarily see it that way. So they often will see their code of ethics or their morality as objective, and they ascribe strongly to it. So that's something to keep in mind with ones. I should actually probably do a whole episode about mistyping. So about what I mean by mistyping is when you think you're one type and are actually a different type, because there can be a lot of confusion between type 1 and type 3, because both are very efficiency oriented and they're all about doing everything well and being productive, but actually their drivers are very different. For ones, it's often like this internal ideal of perfection, whereas for threes, it's a little bit more external and finding worth and productivity. But I'll get to that in just a second. So that's for ones. And when ones are healthy, they have balance and they can see that there is more than one way of doing things, that there's some gray area between black and white. But when they're unhealthy, they're very black and white thinkers. They're very judgmental and very rigid. So if you recognize that in yourself, it's important to note that and pay attention to it. So type twos. Twos are warm and relational. They're motivated by the need to be needed, and they believe they are loved for being lovable and helpful to others. They seek the love of others, and in doing so, they forget their own needs. Twos are in the feeling or the heart center, and they feel a lot, but often they're feeling the feelings of those around them, not their own feelings. They're highly empathetic and able to engage with others in a way that makes those around them feel at home. And the core fear of type 2 is really being unloved, unwanted, or dismissed when they're no longer quote-unquote useful. And so 2s really make themselves indispensable. They make themselves like the person that you always need to have around. And what's hard about that is like they already are that. They don't have to do anything to make themselves better, to make themselves more loved or more loving. They already are all of those things, but they work really hard to be even more essential to everyone around them. And it really feels hurtful when either people say no to their help or when people don't see that how helpful and twos are and how much they're pouring themselves out for others. Twos often have a really hard time with boundaries because they don't realize that like they can do their own thing and it not have a connection with others. Like they constantly see themselves as part of a web of interconnected human beings instead of seeing themselves as their own unique, independent person. When twos are really healthy, they're balanced, they have boundaries, they know that they are loved and worthy without doing anything or helping anyone, and they see themselves as just as needing of that love and affection as they see everyone else as. But when they're unhealthy, they believe that they are only as loved as they are helpful to others. And so they really give to get, and they'll really kind of be manipulative and give to others to cash in on that favor later. Twos are often known as the giver, the helper, or the befriender. So if that motivation, resonates with you, then you might be a two. Type threes. Threes are adaptable and achievement oriented. They're motivated by a need to find their worth and their productivity. They're not just concerned with success, though that often matters to them. They're also concerned with image or appearance. They have an ability to shift and adapt to any environment. And this means that they can relate with anyone they encounter, but they often have a harder time understanding their own identity. Threes are in the feeling center, but they like to stay busy and avoid encountering their emotions. The core fear of type 3 is being worthless, a failure, embarrassed, or unexpectedly exposed. And especially for threes are okay with criticism and taking like constructive criticism, But being unjustly criticized, or what they perceive as unjustly criticized, is absolutely heartbreaking for them. They have a really, really hard time with it. So, and that goes back to that image thing, right? So a lot of the time people teach threes as really success oriented. And I think that's true. But as a three myself, I think what's underneath that is having a vision of like what is worth a lot in society. Like what is worthy? What does it mean to be worthy, to have value in society, and ascribing to whatever that means? And so often threes will work really hard to be that thing. And so it might be being really successful. It might be being an amazing mom. It might be being like the most incredible helper, in a sense, like the most incredible, I don't know, pastor or community member. So those are all things that they might aspire to be. But underneath it, it's like what they're really getting after is that sense of having worth. And threes believe that they don't have worth unless other people believe they have worth. So you can see where they kind of get tripped up. And like twos, threes can have a really hard time with boundaries because they have a hard time separating their own personal self-worth from the worth of others. And threes often seem really confident and self-assured on the outside, but internally they have a lot more insecurity than they let on. When they're really healthy, they're able to take a break. They're able to step back and understand what is theirs to do and say no. And they're able to really focus on what's important to them personally and kind of let go of the rest. And they believe that they have worth as a person rather than how they perform. When they're unhealthy, they become really braggadocious, competitive, and they can be really cutthroat about getting to be the best, to win all the accolades, to get all the prizes, to be really admired, because they want admiration. They think they want admiration, but what they really want is worth. So threes are often called the performer or the achiever. Personally, I like the performer best because the achiever makes it sound like a really great thing to be a three. But I actually think the performer is a more apt description of what's actually going on. So type fours. Fours are deep and complex. They're motivated by a need to find their true heart, and they're on a lifelong quest for understanding and identity. Fours are incredibly imaginative, and they're accustomed to plumbing the depths of their psyche and emotional realm. Often, they have a vision of what the world could be, but it doesn't always fit reality. So they mourn that the world falls short of the extravagance and richness that is possible. And fours are in the feeling or heart center, and they're deeply emotional. They find value and meaning and significance in their lives. And I know that the four description can sound a little woo-woo to a lot of people, but I say it that way because I think that a lot of fours deeply resonate with it. Fours are very deep and introspective, and even a lot of fours aren't melancholy. They don't necessarily mourn necessarily outwardly. They tend to be expressive and love life, but there's still this sense of searching for meaning and significance that is kind of the undercurrent of everything that they do. So fours, their core fear is being insignificant, forgotten, or betraying the self through inauthenticity. So fours are really so focused on being authentic and being who they truly are that they forgo everything else. Like that is all that matters to them in a lot of ways. So that can come out in a few different ways, but one of the ways it comes out most often is that they express their real feelings in the moment at all times. And so that kind of gives them the reputation of being overly emotional, when in reality, maybe a lot of us are feeling those feelings, but we tamp them down. And fours believe that being authentic to who they truly are means expressing that feeling in the moment. So the other thing about fours that's kind of interesting is they commonly are really into the Enneagram, actually, because they are looking for that sense of description and identity. And a lot of fours don't really love the experience of being around other fours. Like, they might enjoy the experience of being around other fours, but when they first learn that they're not the only four in the world, that can be really disorienting and difficult because they're so hell-bent on being unique that they sometimes forget that there are other people like them. And sometimes that means that they end up feeling like, oh, there's nothing wrong with me. Because that's a big thing for fours. They feel like there's something deeply different about them. And sometimes they love that deep difference and sometimes they hate it. And so when they find that other people are like them, they're like, they vacillate between being like, oh yes, other people are just like me. And they vacillate between that and being like, oh, I hate that I'm not the only one. So something to note about fours. And if you are a four and you're listening to this and you're into the Enneagram, you probably already know all this about yourself because you have been doing that deep self-discovery work for a long time. So when fours are healthy, they are balanced. You keep hearing that word come up, right, when I talk about health, because health is really about balance and integration. But when they're healthy, they are more balanced. They are able to move through life without being entirely controlled by their feelings or their emotions. And they can actually have a sense of like rationally detaching from their feelings a little bit and being able to be a little bit more objective about what is good and what they're grateful for in the world around them. When they're unhealthy, they believe that they are the only one who is suffering, and they can be really almost like histrionic, like really, really emotional, and they not only suffer themselves, but they use their feelings to make others around them suffer as well. So they want attention at all times to make sure that other people are as miserable as they feel on the inside. And I know that sounds awful. And I think it also feels really awful for fours. So not only is it hard for other people, but it feels really hard for fours too. So have a little empathy for them. Fours are commonly called the individualist or the romantic. So, and if you are a four, you might love those titles or you might hate them. So that's kind of why, again, why I don't always use them, but that is fours. So fives are observant and cerebral. They're motivated by a need to be competent and self-reliant. And fives often increase their self-reliance by decreasing their needs and desires. Fives are in the head or fear triad, and they use endless pursuit of knowledge as a shield against feeling afraid or anxious, believing that if they know enough, they will be able to reason themselves out of anything in their minds. Fives begin each day with a measured amount of energy, and they conserve their limited resources in order to avoid being depleted. And so this isn't just like being self-reliant, but it's also like they're an iPhone battery. And so they allot in their minds, even subconsciously, they allot a certain amount of battery to every task throughout the day. And they'll shut down or withdraw if something is going to take up more energy or more engagement than they expect and then that they have left. So five's core fear is being incompetent, helpless, or incapable of doing the practical things of life. And so often they will actually kind of shoot themselves in the foot because they end up feeling so like they want to research and they want to have all the knowledge they can about doing the practical things that they end up like not doing them because they're so focused on the research and the knowledge aspect. So for example, maybe they need to get a new water heater and they spend like 3 weeks researching it while they still take a cold shower because they haven't made the right decision yet. And that getting to the end of that processing and research can be really, really challenging for a five. And so sometimes, especially if it's only them, like if it impacts somebody else, they'll have a different response. But if it's only impacting them, they might be okay with taking a cold shower if it means that they feel really confident in their decision. When they're healthy, fives actually see a lot of value in engaging with others and having connection with others. They are able to like both take in information and take the appropriate action that they need to take. And they feel more competent and more energized. But when they're unhealthy, fives often end up like really withdrawing and self-isolating so that they can conserve all their resources and not be impacted by the world around them. So they might get really lost in reading or in gathering information in whatever way that they do that. And they kind of fall asleep to the outside world until They feel safe in their own little personal cocoon that they've made. And often fives are like, people think that they only are like bookworms, but often, I mean, fives just love to learn about anything. So I know people who are fives who are obsessed with like makeup and cosmetics and learning everything possible about every ingredient and kind of really getting into that and creating a real hobby around that. So it doesn't have to be just books that they're really interested in and create a lot of knowledge around. It can be a lot of different things. So that's important to note as well. Fives are often called the investigator or the observer, and both of those are apt titles actually. Fives are very, very observant because they're just constantly taking in information. So type six. Sixes are responsible and community oriented, and they're motivated by a need to find safety and security in the world. They're deeply committed to their loved ones, and they're very loyal. Of all Enneagram types, sixes tend to get the reputation for being the most anxious since they tend to voice their concerns. Sometimes it comes off as pessimism, but they view it as realism. As members of the head or fear triad, sixes make plans and troubleshoot as a way to ward off anxiety. So sixes really believe that if they plan ahead and if they foresee anything bad that might happen before it happens, that they will not feel anxious. And to some extent, that's true, right? But to a greater extent, they often are constant, like their mind is spinning. So sixes are really unique in that there are two types of sixes that are really prominent. Of all the types, there's always the subtypes and the countertypes. So you can go back and listen to episode two for more about that. But for sixes, the two types are very distinct. So we've got phobic sixes. So phobic sixes are kind of like what I just described. They're a lot more fearful. They turn inward and kind of like back away from fear, and they make plans. They tend to have a little bit more of a quieter temperament. Whereas counterphobic sixes, they go at their fear head on. So they have the same fears. They have that same underlying anxiety or insecurity. But what they do with it is that they attack their fears instead of shying away from them. So they might be the person that is, they might look more like an eight, where they are more boisterous or a lot more passionate or a lot more like risk-taking. So that's kind of more the counterphobic six vibe. So you might, if those core fears and the core motivation resonates with you, but it looks really different from the behavior that you see described when talking about sixes, then you might be a counterphobic six. So the core fear of type six is being without connection, support, or protection, and especially the betrayal of trust. So that's kind of their worst fear. They tend to be really suspicious of others. They don't really trust easily. Once they do trust, they're loyal to the core and really like will be in it for the long haul until somebody else gives them a reason not to. But it kind of takes them a while to get there. It takes them a while to trust. And their core fear is really that trust or guidance or really alignment. Like they like to feel aligned and like they have an ally in somebody else. And when that's taken away, that is really destabilizing for sixes. So that's something to note because if you are friends with or you know your partner's a six or something, obviously at that stage when they're friends or partnership, they really trust you and care for you. But it's important to continue to like support their trust and to not kind of like take that away and not betray them. That's big. For both sixes and eights, betrayal is huge. So when sixes are healthy, they are able to see that while bad things will happen, that they don't have to plan ahead for everything. And they're very community oriented and focused on the people around them, and they trust themselves most importantly. So they trust their own inner voice and their own inner sense of being. When sixes are unhealthy, they can get really frantic and very anxious and suspicious of others. They don't trust anyone, and instead they'll keep everyone at arm's length while still wanting that same alignment and ally kind of mentality that I mentioned. So it's kind of almost like a push and pull where they really want that, but they don't really trust someone yet. So when they're really unhealthy, they can kind of have that ambivalence about them. So sixes are often called and this is actually one of the ones that I don't really think a lot of the titles resonate, but they're often called the loyalist, the trooper, or the guardian. I think the guardian is really the best one. Like sixes are very, very loyal, but often they are also very much the guardian. So I like that one best. So type 7. Sevens are quick-minded and versatile. They're motivated by a need to avoid pain or discomfort, especially emotional pain. So they stay busy and seek fun wherever they go. They see the world as full of opportunity and they stay busy to ward off the anxiety present in all head or fear triad types. Sevens have a lot of fun and want to be happy, but they are often so busy planning their next adventure that they forget to enjoy the current moment. It might seem like they're just jumping from one thing to the next because their minds are moving so quickly. And that's something to keep in mind about sevens. Like, seems like they're really random and spontaneous all the time, but their minds just move so quickly that they have thought through those connections and transitions often, but they don't necessarily say them out loud. So it seems like really sporadic. And sevens get a reputation for being really flighty, but I don't think that's fair, mostly because they're just so fascinated and interested by so many different things. That's kind of what they're after. They're after that opportunity, the excitement, the interest, the mystery, all of those types of things. And that's what they're drawn to. So it's not necessarily that they're flighty. It's just that they're drawn to so many different things and ideas. Their worst fear is being trapped in pain, boredom, or limitation. And for sevens, boredom actually feels physically painful a lot of the time. So it's important to keep that in mind. And their worst fear is also being left out. So a lot of sevens feel a lot of fear of missing out because they don't want to miss out on an opportunity. And they want to be thought of, you know, they want to be considered. A lot of the time they can seem like they're not very emotionally connected. And sometimes they aren't emotionally connected to who they are at their core. But that can cause other people to not always reach out and invite them along because either they say no, they don't want to commit, or because the seven seems like they're just always so busy. But in reality, sevens really do want that connection. They want to be invited. They want to be included. So important to keep that in mind. And sevens too are very, like sixes, they are very loyal. They tend to only trust a small few people. So if you're not the person that a seven processes their feelings with, it doesn't mean that they don't have feelings. It just means that you're not the person that they process them with. They have a loyal few that they will talk about those hard things with. And otherwise, they're kind of okay with that. They have a wide net of a lot of different friends, and then typically will have just a couple friends that they're really close with. When they're healthy, they aren't so frantic about moving to the next thing and running into the future. They're a little bit more grounded and they kind of have their head on their shoulders. They tend to be actually pretty ambitious because they have a rebellious streak, and so they don't really want to work for other people. They want to work for themselves. So sevens can be great entrepreneurs, especially when they're healthy. When they're unhealthy, they are frantic about finding the next opportunity or the next thing. They can't sit still. They're always running into the next thing, and they're really like hyped up and looking for an adrenaline rush. Sevens are often called the enthusiast or the epicure because that really captures like their joy and their enthusiasm and how they kind of go through life looking for extravagance, really. So they're a little bit similar to fours in that way. The big difference is how they deal with emotions. Sevens often express and feel the positive emotions, but run from the negatives. Whereas fours are a lot more comfortable with feeling the full range of the emotional spectrum. So both the positive things and the negative things. So type 8. Eights are powerful and dynamic. They're motivated by a need to protect themselves and to avoid vulnerability. Eights have a keen understanding of their own intuition, and they tend to trust their gut to lead them through life. They are truth tellers and highly justice oriented. They will always stick up for the underdog. Eights are in the gut or anger triad, and they tend to confront their anger head on. And they also don't hold on to it. So they're not confronting their anger and then holding a grudge. They tend to confront their anger head on and then kind of let it go. Their assertiveness and volume often cause them to be misunderstood as tough or angry, but they're actually kind and tender once you get to know them. And that's something that's a common misconception about eights. A lot of people think eights are just bullies or jerks. And actually, that's not the case. Eights are, especially when they're in average to healthy spaces, they're kind and considerate, and they really are fierce protectors of their loved ones. The core fear of a type 8 is being controlled, betrayed, violated, or unable to make an impact on the world. And that last one is something that people often don't anticipate, but eights want to make big things happen. They're not just about sitting on the sidelines. Like, they will take a stand. They will absolutely make things happen. Threes and eights often get kind of confused because they have the same energy. They have the same like intensity and passion and like that go-getter attitude. But the big difference is threes are really, like we talked about earlier, threes are really focused on how others perceive them, and eights just don't care about that. Eights are really like, they do care. So I'll say this, like eights care if others like them or not, but if somebody doesn't like them, they're not going to sit there and try to convince them. They're like, all right, I'm going to move on. Because eights are looking for the people who they can be their full authentic selves with, and they don't have to quiet themselves or turn themselves down. And they're looking for people with whom they can find that connection and almost like that matched intensity. So that's important to note about eights. Eights also kind of get a reputation for being angry or intense. And that really comes from a sense of passion that they have. But it's really just like they communicate all of their ideas with the same intensity and like the same passion that they would anything. And so it's not that they're angry. It's just that that's how they communicate that they care. That's important to note, especially if you're in a relationship with an eight and you tend to assume they're always angry. They're probably not angry at you. So it's actually really helpful to ask them, is this anger? and try to understand it. And also just be direct. Not confrontational necessarily, but eights typically don't shy away from confrontation. So being direct and stating your needs is really important to have a positive and close relationship with an eight. When they're healthy, they are kind and tenderhearted. They tend to be really altruistic and, they really see the best in everyone around them and bring that out. When they're unhealthy, they can be domineering and controlling. They don't trust others, and they're actually can be really like brash and overly intense. So that's when they're unhealthy. They're often called the challenger. And I think that's a decent name, though. Eights, I think, are the most misunderstood Enneagram type. And so often hearing the challenger makes them feel like there's something wrong with them. And that's not what we want to communicate. So I don't use that title. But it has kind of a negative connotation. And a lot of the memes and the descriptions that you'll see about eights have a really negative connotation, when in reality, they're awesome. They're like great people. I love eights. I love being around eights. And so if you don't know any eights, get to know them and also be a little bit considerate and aware of the way that you're perceiving things, and kind of get curious if the negative perception is coming from you or if it's actually true about how they're functioning in the world. Finally, type nines. So nines are harmonious and agreeable. They are motivated by a need to find internal and external peace to the point that they often forget to give attention to their own thoughts, feelings, and desires. As members of the gut triad, they often ignore their own sense of intuition and they repress their anger for fear of causing conflict. They are natural mediators and peacemakers who make others feel at home, and they tend to be kind, connective, and deliberate. So how I often like to talk about nines is they're trying to keep the internal and external peace, right? So imagine standing with your arms straight out to your sides, and there's a force pushing against one arm towards you, and then a force pushing against the other arm towards you. So you're using your hands and pushing both sides away. That is how I think a lot of nines experience life. So they're pushing the external world out and the internal world in, and they're kind of caught in this limbo. And they're trying not to be impacted by it. And what ends up happening is they end up exhausted. And so that's a lot of the time nines get called like the sloth, or it's said that they have less energy. And I don't think it's necessarily like they have less energy. I think it's they spend all of their energy tamping down everything else, so they don't have any energy left for themselves, or to take care of themselves or care for themselves, anything like that. So I think that's what's really underneath it, and pushing against those forces. So nines have this unique ability to like turn off their minds so they can just coast. And other types, most other types can't really do that. Most other types, you know, they get caught up in their thinking or they get caught up in their emotions, but nines really can turn it off. And that's what gives them that reputation also for like, oh, nines just always want a nap. And it really has to do with tuning things out and being able to zone out, turn off their brain and just be. And what's hard about that for nines is that the longer they turn it off for, the harder it is to turn it back on because it takes so much energy to switch from off to on. And nines are all about comfort. And so they don't want to experience that challenge and difficulty. They want to be comfortable and at peace. Their core fear is being unable to find peace or feeling disconnected from loved ones. And so that disconnection really happens in nine's mind when they stand up for themselves or assert themselves. So they believe that if they assert themselves, that they will cause discord, disconnection. And so instead of stating their needs or stating what they want for dinner, they will kind of quiet that down so that they can keep the peace and feel connected. Healthy nines understand that they can assert themselves and they can speak their mind and it won't cause that rift. It won't cause the disconnection or disunity. That their voice actually matters and that people around them want to hear what they have to say. Because that is the thing that's so true about nines, is that people around them actually do want to hear what they have to say. And unhealthy nines really fall into what's called narcotizing, meaning like tuning out, zoning out, like I was saying, and instead of feeling their real feelings or expressing their real emotions, they choose something else that feels more comfortable. So that might be reading or watching TV or napping or drinking, eating, etc. So it's something else that makes them feel a lot more comfortable than actually thinking or processing or being an active agent in their lives. So that's kind of what happens when nines are really unhealthy. Nines are called the peacemaker or the mediator. And both of those, I think, are really good names for nines. They're a peacemaker. The only reason I hesitate to use that one is because I don't want nines to get so comfortable with becoming a peacemaker at their own expense. They tend to get called that, and people love that about them. And sometimes when people are encouraging them to be such peacemakers, they don't realize that the nine is kind of losing themselves in playing that role. So really important for nines to believe that their voice matters, that their presence matters, their opinion matters, and yeah, to focus on getting out of that tendency to kind of tune things out and take a more active role in their lives. So those are all nine types. I hope you really found that helpful. And going through that today, I basically walked you through my self-typing guide, which is free. So that's on my website and it's also on my Instagram page, and I'll also put it in the show notes. So if you want to just read through what I already just talked about, there's a simpler format of today's episode. You can download that in text format. So that's the free self-typing guide. So thanks so much again for tuning in today. I hope you found this really helpful and valuable. If you did, I would love if you would just leave a review so that other people can end up finding this podcast, and definitely share it with your friends. I think this is a great one to share with friends and family who don't know the Enneagram and want to understand the types in a little bit more detail and depth. And I will say also, we barely scratched the surface today. There's so much more to the Enneagram, but I hope you found it valuable, and I hope you found it, even if you're not familiar with the Enneagram previously, I hope this kind of you know, piqued your interest a little bit, and you'll continue learning, continue that self-discovery journey, and yeah, focus on that. If after this episode, you still are like, I really can't find my type, I have a couple solutions for you. One, like I said, continue journaling, meditating, self-reflecting. Go find podcasts. So there are a few different podcasts I like. One is Suzanne Stabile's The Enneagram Journey. Another is The Art of Growth. And both of those have really great long-form interviews and or panels. And it's really, really, really helpful to understand what it's like to be inside the mind of each of these types. So say you have narrowed it down. You're like, I'm either a 4 or a 6 and I cannot figure it out. Listening to a 4 talk about what it's like to be inside their mind, and listening to a six talk about that, it's, you'll see the big differences, and it'll really help you narrow it down and see what you resonate with. So that's one way to further narrow down your type. The second way is just to talk with an Enneagram coach. So I'm an Enneagram coach. I do typing sessions. It's my most popular service. And I'll put the link in the show notes as well. But there are also a lot of other Enneagram coaches out there that can really help you understand your type and really understand your core motivation. And so typically that's done through conversation. And what I do is I help you figure out your core type and your most likely subtype through just a 40 to 45 minute long conversation. And then I'll send you a couple growth tips. Those are always really customized based on what you need. Maybe it's a book, maybe it's a task or a journal prompt, but I customize those. So there are a lot of us out there. It's not just, I'm not the only Enneagram coach, but I want you to really feel like there are resources available for you to help you find your type so that you can actually find the growth that you want. And another thing, if you listen to podcasts, you don't want to do the Enneagram coaching thing right now, another tactic you could try is just to try it on. So act like it's a pair of jeans and go take like your Enneagram type for a spin for a few days. So maybe you think, okay, I'm a four, and just see what it would be like to live life as a four. Try to do some growth tips for type fours or filter things through that type four lens and see if that fits. And if it doesn't, then you revisit and you think about it again. So hopefully those few tips will really help you find your type. Let me know. Let me know what you think. Let me know if it helps. You can shoot me an email or send me a DM on Instagram. Always happy to chat more about the Enneagram. And thank you so much for tuning in. And I hope you have a great week. And I'll see you back here next Thursday.